we were doing a film. There was a film called Poetic Justice. And I had a trailer. And I walked out the first morning, and there was a person cursing, using words. I mean, I've heard them, but not in such combination. And he didn't stop when he saw me. I didn't recognize him, and I thought no more about it then. He was just wrong. The next day I came out, and this young man, another black young man, his age, were standing up face to face using the most vile language. And you knew any minute they were going to come to blows. One black man of age went up to these two young men and tried to talk to them. So he got one. I went to the other. And I said, excuse me. He said, I wouldn't give. I said, I understand that. I said, please let me speak. If they didn't. I said, yes, I see that. But when was the last time anyone told you that it's all for you? That we've lived 300 years on the edge of a dime so that you could exist? When is the last time? Do you know that we stood on slave ship decks and stood on auction blocks and were hosed down like dogs for you so that you could live? Well, he started to cry. So I put my arm around his waist and walked him down. There was a little, like a ditch. And I kept his back to the people because they started coming back. I'm sure they were afraid of random shooting or something. And I just talked to him. And I had no handkerchief or Kleenex, so I just cleaned his face with my hands and talked to him. And when he was composed and I was composed, we went back up to the level. And I continued to my trailer. I sat there when Janet Jackson came running in. She said, Dr. Angelo, I don't believe you just talked to Tupac Shakur. I didn't know Six-Pack. I never heard of anybody named Tupac. That was not my music. It's not my generation.
So, all of you Africans that know how to do facts, that's working for other people, y'all need to open your own business. Save your money. Quit paying motherfuckers for Jerry Curls. Quit paying motherfuckers for proms. Save your money. Start your own business.
Wake up, jumped out my bed. I'm in a two-man cell with my homie little half dead.
Welcome to the program, everyone. It's your boy Malcolm Riddle in the house. Mariam Tazi, how are you today? Oops, you're on mute. Let's see if we can.
I heard it.
We're having some problems here, people. But don't worry. Try it again. Mariam Tazi, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
There we go. And we're sitting here in front of my main man, my mellow, the hip-hop restaurateur. I got it right this time. Rick Marrero in the house.
What's up?
What's up?
Nothing.
You know it. So we're just paying a little respect to the late, great Maya Angelou, who passed away this week. We found out. Yeah. Very sad, huh?
Yeah.
And that was a clip from the movie One Night. Well, the 30 for 30, ESPN's 30 for 30, One Night in Vegas, where she recaps an interaction she had. Why am I talking like this, people? An interaction she had with Tupac Shakur.
Nice.
So, and as you know, she was in the movie Poetic Justice with Tupac.
And Janet.
And Janet Jackson, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Different time back then, huh?
Yeah.
It seems like it was a long time ago.
It
was a long time ago, actually.
When did Poetic Justice come out?
It was a long time ago.
Early 90s?
Yeah.
I think. I can look it up.
Yeah, look it up real quick. Good movie. One of my favorites. One of my favorites from Tupac. I mean, when you think of Maya Angelou's passing, you think of almost
93.
An end of... It kind of signifies the end of an era. I mean, when you start losing the greats like that, that have came so long, that have marched the march, that struggled the struggle, and, you know, has been here for people that probably don't even know who she is.
I have no idea.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know who she is.
Yeah.
You know, I've recently walked up to people of a younger generation and ask them, you know, do they know who Ray Charles was?
Oh, yeah.
And they don't know. Or
they got to teach it in school.
Or they don't
kids
know.
Kids have to learn it in school they're not going to find out on their own.
I found out
on my own.
Well, we're older. but not anymore.
Yeah, but you know because your parents or someone in your crew is reading poetry by Maya Angelou, or they're listening to blues by Ray Charles, or they're listening to Miles Davis. You know what I mean? Like, there's not a lot of as much information as we have at our fingertips right now. Not a lot of information far as the past.
No, they don't look back.
And what brought you where you're at now?
Yeah, people
you know
don't really
mean?
Do research on history.
Well, schools aren't about culture anymore.
That's true too.
No,
it's about numbers, math, science.
I was in
and how we compete against the rest of the world.
But we're not competing. We're not.
Not on those levels either.
That's why the focus is so much now on standardized testing and the core that all the my sister's a teacher. These core standards, and they're asking
No Child Left Behind
these
stuff,
questions
right?
on these tests that people can't relate to. I mean, my sons don't come home talking about, I learned about Ray Charles, or I remember learning about Langston Hughes in sixth grade. My teacher at the time.
You had to know.
We were reading poetry by Langston Hughes.
Yeah, now it's if it's not part of the curriculum, you can't talk about it.
Yeah, there's no time. The teachers are so pressed to, you know, get these kids ready for the tests. Not necessarily ready. I mean, I know they're just elementary or middle school, but
I mean,
there's some part of it. You culture is probably more important.
But you got to know. If you don't know, man, you're just going through life lost. I was in a store recently, and I was working, and they're playing over the speaker some music, right? And it was More Bounce to the Ounce by Zapp. You know what I mean? Roger Troutman. So I got on the speaker and said, pay respect. That's Roger Troutman. You know what I mean? He innovated what's called auto-tune, right?
He made Kanye West's career.
So the point I was trying to make was I went around the room to see how many people knew who Roger Troutman was. And did they know Zapp? And if they didn't, I didn't make fun of them or ridicule them. I just said, just download Zapp. The best of. You know what I mean? If you want. And you're going to have a great night.
Especially now. You have access to so much information.
And then I tell him.
You can learn anything about anything.
And I told him, I said, download it. I was like, Roger Troutman is the same voice used on California Love with Tupac Shakur. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Pour a little bit out for my homie that's not here anymore. Rest in peace, Roger Troutman. But, you know, it was a whole movement that got us where you're at now with the likes of a Kanye West. So you got to be able to do the math. But yeah, it's astonishing. So I'm scared to even take a poll and see how many people know or don't know who Maya Angelou is or was or what she meant to this country, to African American, just the people, not just one race, just the people. So yeah, that clip we just played and we moved into was from One Night in Vegas, which you can probably download on iTunes, or it's on the web, it's on YouTube. It chronicles the relationship between Mike Tyson and shows the parallel between Mike Tyson and Tupac Shakur and their lives. And speaking of knowing your history, Rick Marrero, the hip-hop restaurateur, has produced this podcast. This podcast is produced by Desiderio in Gainesville, Virginia. And I'd like to say, big ups to Rick for pulling out the Tats crew, which we're getting ready to sit down and interview with via phone. Tats crew are a legendary graffiti crew out of the Bronx. And, Rick knew a guy next to the guy, right?
Yeah. I went to school with Rob. And Rob's a friend, and I think at times works with them. And those guys do stuff all over the city, all over the world. You know, they're graffiti artists for hire.
Yeah.
And growing up in the Bronx, or I guess in any inner city, you see those trains go by, and you always wonder, how did that get there?
Yeah.
Who did that? You know, when are they doing it? You know, and it's everywhere. And I know that that's one of the reasons that they did their art, their pieces on trains is because they went all over the city. Everybody could see them everywhere. Mm-hmm. Those trains went everywhere. So it was always a mystery to me. It was one of those things.
Fascinating.
It, one of those things. And then you started to see the guys. You know, you got to, you know a guy who knew a guy. And, you know, the guys would show up at my building at 9 o'clock at night with bags of spray cans. And you knew where they were going, you know. And then they stopped. If you were, I don't know, under 15 years old, you couldn't buy spray paint anywhere in my neighborhood. It just, they wouldn't. You know, and the whole culture, and there were certain caps that guys used, and then the markers, and everybody wanted to be, you know, get a piece of that. We all tried it. Not everybody was good at it.
That's true.
I also had to be home by 8 o'clock, so I couldn't really do any shit on.
Yeah, I took my stab back yeah. in the, I took my stab at it back in the 80s. I was known as Kid Fresh.
Oh.
I was, what? What, man? I was
Kid Fresh.
That's right. I was Kid Fresh out of Flint, Michigan, and I would go around tagging things.
Well, there are definitely guys that are well known, and you know, we'll talk to these guys about a guy called, his name was Tracy
168. Yeah,
I don't want to say world famous because I don't know how, but as far as graffiti artists in New York, he's older now. I don't even know.
Well, they should be
in his 50s.
They should be calling in a second. So, yeah. Go ahead and keep talking for a second.
Yep. So that was one of the, I mean, that's one of the things that, like I said, I always wanted to be a part of it. I could never, there's no way I could be a graffiti artist. I mean, and just the word artist itself meant so much.
I was going to say, it's very creative and stuff, yeah. And it's not easy to do. I remember some of my friends too were trying to get into it, and it's like, it's definitely a skill. I'd always be like, yo, make me something, you know,
yeah.
Like make me something.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's not easy. It takes time, you know, everything like the pens, the brands, the colors, just like you have your signature, like writing, you know, or style with your lettering and all that stuff. Like it's not easy.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful.
I mean, those guys are, it's amazing. And now to see it, I don't know when it all started to become more accepted as a true art form. Where they're doing art shows, they're doing gallery shows.
Well, they
now,
do like murals and stuff, you
yeah,
know. When
yeah.
it's, I think there's a difference between tagging, you know,
and
then making murals and things like that. But it's still in certain cities, it's still allowed. Like a lot of places still paint over that stuff.
Yeah.
But there are places, Montreal, they leave it up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's certain cities that they just totally leave
yeah.
it because they're just starting to appreciate
and that,
it.
And that's a culture. I mean, graffiti. I mean, hip hop, music. That travels outside of the inner city through
mm-hmm.
you know iTunes, the radio. But graffiti is one of those things that you don't see it out here. Or how do you? It's one of the things that you can't experience unless you go
to a city.
To a city, and even then, you know, you're going to see murals now. There's no graffiti on trains anymore.
Yeah.
So how do kids or people learn about that culture, and it's old school. It's old at
it's
this
a
point.
Lot more organized now, it seems, you know. It'll be like, this
yeah.
is a section you can actually do this
yeah.
in, like do it up, you
yeah.
know what I mean, like this
yeah.
is a facade you can
yeah
just
and
do
I guess
you
know with YouTube
and
the internet, you know, there's ways to find out, and my older son loves it. I don't know how, and this is actually one of the things that got me looking, because the Tats Crew, they sell things
mm-hmm.
online.
Yeah, I saw that on the Facebook.
Yeah, pieces and things. And I wanted to get him one for his room because he's somehow drawn to that. You know, so I'll go on YouTube and they have how-to videos.
Well, let's I got the Tats Crew on the horn right now. Maybe we can answer up some of those questions. Hello?
Hello.
How's it going?
Pretty good.
Good. So I'm sitting with Rick Marrero. We coined his name as the hip-hop restaurateur. He's from the Bronx. He set this whole...
All right, what's up?
What's going on?
And then I'm sitting with Mariam Tazi, straight out of Morocco.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I heard you guys just got back from Morocco.
Yeah, we're in Marrakesh. We went to a wedding of a fellow artist of ours, a friend of ours, and then we stood around for an art exhibit. So we painted the stuff there. We stood about 7 days, and then we stood for the opening. And Morocco's, if you've never been, it's definitely a place that you've got to visit.
Yeah. Good call. Thank you.
Yeah, no, no. The people, I mean, the food.
The food.
You know, but you got to step your French up. You got to step your French or your Arabic up, and you're good. But
that's true.
You know, being from the South Bronx, I got a little bit over with the Spanish just because, you know, there's a lot of people that, you know, are there from Spain. So yeah. I kind of, like, gravitated around, you know.
Nice.
But it was a dope trip.
I'm glad you liked it.
And if you could introduce yourself to the audience, please.
Okay, my name is Nicer. I'm one of the founding members of Tatch Crews. I've been painting since 1980. I was the last generation on the subway trains, and we've kind of like are more known because we've kind of broken the barriers and opened doors for graffiti to be, you know, the viable art form that it is today. We've kind of, I think we actually are noted for being the first graffiti company of its kind.
Yeah.
So graffiti itself, when did you first notice graffiti? I know me growing up in the 80s, it was just part of it. It was part of the fashion. It was part of the music.
Yeah.
It was the DJing. And graffiti was just there. I didn't really realize how much I didn't know about graffiti. I mean, I knew, like, the basics. I knew some of the Philadelphia artists and stuff like that. But I don't really know the essence of it and how it integrates with the elements of hip-hop.
Right, right. Well, I'll just break it down really quick, I guess. I grew up in the in New York in the 70s, so it was kind of always around me. And, I mean, being a kid in the city during that time, I mean, there were really, the city was bankrupt, so there were no art programs. The school was barely funded. I mean, I remember one school year where they weren't even picking up the trash in the schools, so the bags would just pile up. But I mean, the city was in financial ruin almost, and because of that, a lot of the teens kind of just gravitated to this art form that we know of as graffiti. You know, they took to it because it was some way of expressing themselves, and, you know, just being, you know, able to put your name up on something that, you know, we would paint trains here in the Bronx and it would travel through Manhattan and end up in Brooklyn. It kind of like was our way of sending smoke signals across the city just to let other, you know, other teens or other writers, we called each other writers, just to know that, you know, we were out there and we exist. So, but from that, I mean, as a kid, it was always around me. And I guess I grew up at the very beginning of hip hop. I mean, I seen, you know, the jams in the parks, the jams on my block, I didn't know it was an actual phenomenon or something that was going to be as big as it gotten. I mean, for me, it was just something that we did. It was just natural to us. We had our own dance, we had our own music, we had, you know, our own art form. I mean, even looking at it back now, I remember doing flyers and lead jackets but I would have never thought that, you know, 30 years forward, you know, it would be where it is now. But, I mean, you know, back then, to break graffiti down, in its rawest, it started out as a subculture. We did it for each other's attention. We did it for other graffiti writers to notice, not for the mainstream, not, I mean, we couldn't care. I mean, the average, person riding the train back and forth to work can care less about the graffiti on the outside of the trains. For them, it was a nuisance just because they would miss their stops because they couldn't look out the window because we would paint, like, the whole cars. So, but for us, there were no faces to the names. We were, you know, we could be on an actual subway train and be on the actual car with a rival graffiti artist. And not know, you know, who was who because there were no websites, there were no magazines, there were no, you know, it was all about, you know, how you got up, how you, you know, how you painted your name, you know, how you bombed, how, you know, so it was really a subculture that was our thing. We did it for each other's attention. And it wasn't till like the 80s that, guys that were before us from the 70s, guys like Lee and Crash and Lady Pink, and, you know, there was a group of artists that were already painting subway trains, which was our school, because we didn't have an internet. We didn't have books to go to. For us, how we wanted to learn about graffiti, you know, meant that you went to the train station, you sat on a bench the entire day, and you would watch these trains roll by, and you kind of, like, went to school. But, you know, but it wasn't until, like, the early 80s, I guess, where a lot of these guys that were painting trains before us and that we learned from, they started to go into galleries. So for us, we were still painting subway trains, and for us, we were the shit because, you know, we were the last survivors. We were the ones that were still painting and still getting busy. But, you know, but these older cats that went before us, I would see them at gallery shows and be like, wow, you know, like, that's a switch. You know, like, now there's a face. Now I know what Lee looks like. Now I know what Crash looks like. So, you know, it was kind of strange to see graffiti go out of this, you know, go from this, like, you know, this underground subculture to, like, kind of out in the public eye. But I guess the real turning point was when the documentary, like, Star Wars, Henry Chalfant's documentary,
yeah,
about graffiti, when that came out, and then a little movie called Beat Street came out, which I was totally against, because I remember going to the movies to see that and being like, what the hell is this? I'm watching this graffiti writer named Ramo, and, you know, he's living in an abandoned building, and he's painting furniture on the wall. I'm like, shit, I've been painting trains for all these years. I have a dresser. This guy painted a dresser on his wall.
And a fireplace, too. He had a fireplace.
I was being, like, exploited. So I was like, I don't live like that. But you know, it wasn't till, you know, all of a sudden there was a spotlight on graffiti and, you know, our thing, our culture, that, you know, we did it for ourselves, like the breakdancing, the DJing, the MCing, and, you know, all this stuff. We did it amongst each other for, you know, we became our own little ghetto celebrities, so, and we were fine with that. But it wasn't till, like, all of a sudden, you know, there was this, like, Hollywood interest that was going on.
I think like with MTV, and then that explosion, it just snowballed.
Yeah, I mean, and for me, it was like, you know, hey, that's cool, but I'm gonna keep doing what I do. You know what I mean? Like, and we were pretty fortunate because my partner Bio grew up in Bronx River. So early on, even if you look at the very first video from Bambada, like Planet Rock. All the graffiti that you saw in the Bronx River, you know, community center, we did that. So Bam would hire us. So even back then, we kind of like broke the barrier where we were being commissioned, like as teens, to, you know, do what we do on subway trains and get paid for it. So Bam always made sure we got paid for a lot of that stuff. And with that, we did stuff for Jazzy J. Like, we've always did stuff for, like, you know, the rap community and the hip-hop community back then. But we didn't, you know, set out to do it intentionally. It was just we were at the right place in the right time. So Bam was one of the first people that made sure we were getting commissioned and we were getting paid. And for us, we did it for, hey, you know, let's do it. And if we made a little cash, we made cash. But if not, we had leftover paint to go paint the train.
And so listeners listening, when you say Bam, you mean African Bambaataa, right?
Yes, Africa Bambaataa.
All right.
So, I mean, even if you look at the videos after that, we've did stuff like Renegades of Funk for him, the graph that's in there. You see some of our crew members in there, like Brim and Shame 125 and a few of the other guys. So it's kind of like we've always done stuff, you know, that was always hip-hop, you know, kind of, you know, you know, we were kind of there at the beginning, but we didn't realize and we didn't actually plan out. Like, a lot of these artists nowadays kind of, like, they map out what they're going to do to get attention. We were just in the mix. And for us, it was like, you know, it was always about the fame. And that's what, you know, graffiti, in essence, has always been cored around. If you look at it from the very beginning, I mean, it's basically, it's kind of like a modern-day version of calligraphy.
Yeah.
It started out as, like, you know, someone's signature, and, you know, and it evolved from there, and it's gone through an evolution throughout history. Like, you know, if you look at the very beginning, somebody took a tag with a spray can, and somebody saw that and said, you know what, I'm going to do that same thing, but I'm going to do an outline around it. Then someone else saw that and said, you know what, I'm going to do those same two steps, but I'm going to put dots in mine. So everyone that's participated in this has helped elevate it and bring it to kind of, you know, help its evolution. I mean, if you would have told me or asked me, you know, or would have told me 30 years ago that I could sit at a computer and, you know, and render like a graffiti piece, print it out and take it to a wall and paint it, I would look at you like you were nuts. So I'd be like, you know, what are you smoking? I want three of those.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because, but it's part of the evolution of, I guess, anything that has creativity involved in it, because it's gonna, you know, everyone that participates in it takes it to the next level.
Now, do you think that, or do writers, graffiti writers, consider themselves separate from rap culture or hip hop culture, or is it one union?
Well, I'll be totally honest, like my opinion. Even when I was painting subway trains in the 80s, I mean, I started in 1980, all the way through 86. And, you know, and there were guys that were, you know, these white boys that were into heavy metal, hardcore, like Black Sabbath, Led Zeppelin. And, you know, and they would show up in train yards and you were like, oh, shit. You know, you didn't look at them as, like, you know, guys that weren't into rap music. I guess for us, you know, we were always, it was always part of hip-hop just because of the neighborhoods that we grew up in. So I remember doing Lee jackets for people, for like, you know, guys from New York City Breakers and you know, backdrops for, you know, Rocksteady, and, you know, doing backdrops for like, you know, Funky Four, and doing, you know, stuff at the Fever. And like we've always been, like, graffiti has somehow always been in that mix of hip-hop just because it was in the same communities. The guys like us that were in those communities were the visual voices for a lot of, you know, what was going on.
Now, the parallels between today's graffiti and today's rap music, you know, where there's so much money involved, is there more of an underground scene still thriving in the world of graffiti, as just like it is, you know, in rap? You know, it's just,
well,
saturated.
Again, like my opinion, and for what I've seen, and you know, I've been doing this over 30 years now. So I remember being a teenager, I think I was 17 at the time. It was my very first trip abroad. Here's a kid that's 17 from the South Bronx, from, you know, the Hunts Point section. All of a sudden, you're on an airplane on your way to England to go, you know, paint some walls, and you're getting paid for it. So it was like, the hell is going on here?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, a few weeks ago, I was being chased in a subway tunnel from cops. Now, like, they're paying me to go abroad. But I guess one of the biggest explosions and of, like, the visual part of, like, this hip-hop, like, you know, the graffiti, was the invention of the internet, and the magazines that came just slightly before the internet. I explained to you how I learned graffiti. I sat at a subway station and physically would watch these trains roll by, and they would stop, you know, across from me, and I would study what was there. Because of magazines, you know, stuff like Subway Art and all these other, even rap magazines had, like, Lee jackets that had airbrushing on them, like, the guys that were doing it over in Queens, you know. But it was kind of like, you know, it was that introduction that you know, those, it was that way that people outside of New York were introduced to what was going on here, the movement, the underground movement. So now, because of the internet, I mean, I've been pretty fortunate where I've been in places like, you know, all over Europe. I've been to Israel, been to Africa, been, you know, edges of, I mean, I've been places where I say to myself, like, how the hell did you know about graffiti? And I get emails from kids from, I mean, there was this one kid that sent me an email one time. He painted a barn out in Colombia. It was like some little village in Colombia. But if you looked at the piece, it was dope, and it was detailed, and it was up to par with today's standards. And it's all due to the internet. And it's because now our thing that was just this New York City underground thing has now become our thing, a global, you know, community, because it's now, because of the access that you have, the easy access to, like, you know, graffiti, that, you know, people around the world, you know, can learn how it's done, you know, how it looks like, and do their version of it.
Yeah, and I see that in graffiti, where graffiti's evolution, like you said, is you have a wider audience because of the internet. Whereas when I see rap music and DJing, their evolution is changed quite a bit in style, but graffiti has pretty much stayed on track. True?
Yeah, but you know, my answer to that is I've seen it with my own eyes. I think last year I was in Poland.
Yeah.
And there was like this whole weekend rap jam. The dogs, even though you don't understand what the hell they're saying because you don't speak the language,
yeah,
but you understand flow and yeah, you understand style, you understand funk, and to see somebody, I mean, it's incredible to see that. You don't understand it, but it got so much funk and flow that lyrically, whatever they say, that shit is hot. And you're like, the same thing happened to me when I was in China. We went to an event, and here's these kids rapping in Japanese, but between the beats, and because they appreciate it for what it is, and it's a shame that here, you know, where it's born, it's got so washed down that, you know, I don't even know what direction it's going. To be totally honest, I don't even listen to radio anymore.
No. Yeah, none
of us do.
I have my own playlist. Yeah. I have my own playlist. Yeah. Even my wife goes, what the hell is that? I haven't heard. My wife is younger than me, by the way. So she's like, I like, you remember this? And you're playing, like, you know, like some old Cutting Crew joints. Yeah. Stuff, and they're like, she's like, eh, no, I never heard that.
No, we're on the same page.
Yeah, because it's like, it's so, but to go abroad and see, you know, people in Italy, in France, and I mean, everyone's got their, like, they're bringing it back to where it was here, and when it really had feeling and funk, and it had flow. You know flow when you hear flow.
Yeah. Yeah, and the flow is missing in a lot of stuff they play on the radio today. I mean, I don't know what it is, but it is missing. And KRS-One, I saw a clip, I can't remember, I think I was just on YouTube or somewhere, where he was saying he spends more time overseas because they appreciate the the older artists more. They get more love and they get paid more over there than they do here where it was born.
Yeah, it's crazy. I was at an event in Spain, and their lineup, because I was on stage because we had painted some backdrops, we were there to do, so I painted alongside, like everywhere I go I try to always paint along with locals, because I want to learn. Like for me, this is, I'm still learning, even though I've been doing this over 30, I'm still excited by it. I still have those days where I'm like, oh, this don't look right, oh, I'm gonna fix, but you learn from the old guys and you learn from the, like, it's still exciting to me. But I watched this lineup in the show in Spain, and it was Big Daddy Kane, it was CL Smooth, and it just was endless. And it was like, yo, it's like you had your radio rocking from, like, it's like you can close your eyes and you were still late 80s, early 90s, listening to hip-hop in New York City. And when you opened your eyes again, it was like, man, we're not even in New York. It's like, it's a shame that things like that, you know, aren't more, you know, praised and valued here.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess it's like graffiti in a way, it was like that here in New York City or in the United States for a long time, because we were getting so much appreciation for what we were doing visually abroad, and that I kind of said to myself one day, it's kind of like jazz, where jazz was from here, and it was like, you know, it has all its origins and the mixture of different musics and all this, and then, you know, it wasn't until it was appreciated over here that, you know, then the United States was like, yeah, that's our thing, that's our thing. But it, in reality, at the very beginning, you didn't even pay attention to it. You didn't even appreciate it. So it's kind of like that for, like, graffiti artists. It was like, you know, that's one of the reasons why early on we say, you know what, we're not getting the light and the respect we need, because there was a time in the 90s before we started our company where, If they wanted to use, first of all, magazines didn't have people of color in it. If you remember back in like the late 80s. So if you saw any advertisement for like a clothing line that had any so-called street art or graffiti in it, everything looked like Keith Harry. And I was like, that shit ain't even real graffiti. So we would be upset. But then the reality is, as adults, like, you can't get upset, because who are they going to reach out to? I mean, this is obviously done in some art department, but you know what? You know, if we don't give it a place and we don't have a place where we can say, here, you can call us on this number and you can reach us at this office. Otherwise, you know, you're just another artist that can't be, you know, found, and you can't represent, you know, what you believe in. So we started the company, you know, with that basis behind it. Like, let's create a place where, you know, where they can, if they want to hire a graffiti artist, you know, legitimately, this is where they can find it.
And what's the name of your company?
Oh, it's called Tats Crew. Well, we have three, but we're always known as Tats Crew. But Top Artistic Talent, you can find us online. It's tatscrew.com and .net. I mean, there's the Tats Crew Facebook pages. I mean, you know, we've been doing this for a while, so it's like we got in on that internet stuff early on. So.
And, yeah, that's another thing that I'm starting to see. I'm starting to see in movie theaters here in the Washington, D.C. area where they have or their version of graffiti. But some of the stuff looks legit. Some of the theaters I've been going to, I know Facebook, their corporate office, I think, who was it, David Cho, did the graffiti there. And you're starting to see it. You're starting to see.
Well, I tell you why a lot of that is going on, because the people that are in positions to employ art now are the 30-year-olds, the 40-year-olds, the ones that grew up understanding this art form. And this is part of, you know, it's part of what they know, and it's acceptable now. The people that were in those positions before were people that were so out of the loop from what went on in you know, urban communities throughout the United States. These are people that didn't understand the breakdancing, the rap music. Dogs, you get up now, I tell these kids every day, like when I do lectures in schools, it's like, you don't know how fortunate you are that you can get up, turn on the radio, and you hear rap in the morning.
Yeah.
I could only hear rap music on Friday night and Saturday night between a certain time and a certain time, it was done. So if you didn't have your little tapes ready and recorded your music for that 2 or 3 hour span, that's what you heard for the rest of the week. And then at the next Friday or the next Saturday, then you went over that same tape with whatever. So it was like, you know, and it's, you hear rap jingles on commercials, McDonald's commercials, all these, and it's, it throws me back sometimes. I say to myself, wow, times have changed.
No, I'm from the same era, and I'm amazed. I mean, when I see the likes of a Jay-Z sitting up while Barack Obama is being sworn in, I just look at that as a...
And then, you know what, eventually, and so kind of the same thing is going on with graffiti, because I'll give you a good example. We used to paint illegally on handball courts. Now, as, you know, grown men and having, you know, our company, we're actual Board of Ed vendors. So the same, you know, people that used to chase us off their property are now, you know, commissioning us to do, you know, murals in schools throughout New York City. And I guess one of the biggest aha moment in my life was we were invited once to the Smithsonian Institute to represent New York City graffiti on their Great Lawn. If you ever been, like, to where all those museums are, they have, like, this huge lawn. So the guy asked me one day, he goes, you know, what do you guys, we're going to build you guys something to paint on. What would you like to? I said, well, you know, now we paint on walls, so if you build me a building, you know, I'll paint on that. And I kind of said it jokingly, and within 3 days, I had an entire, like, architectural rendering of a fake building they were going to build us, and they did it. And we painted it for 11 days, and at the end of, I remember painting there one day and looking to my left and seeing the Capitol building, then looking to my right and seeing the the monument there, and I was like, what the hell am I doing here?
Yeah.
Like, this is so surreal. I'm like, you know, any minute now, I'm waiting for the cops to run out of the bushes and go, freeze!
Well, I think that a lot of people, and you hit this point, that the kids today have so much freedom and access to stuff that they really don't realize, and I've said this on this show before, they really don't realize how short of a time span that was when there weren't any people of color in TV commercials. There was no hip-hop. There was no rap. There was nothing. I've talked on this show how we used to get happy if we saw a person of color in a movie. You know what I mean? Because because there were no presidents. There were no managers of football teams. There was nothing. We had Dr. J. We had O.J. Simpson growing up. We had Magic Johnson. We had Michael Jackson. You know, we had these figures, but it didn't dominate the playing field like it is now.
No, so, and I agree with that. Well, listen, I'm a Puerto Rican from New York City, so the way we were represented on whether it was television or movies, you always saw a needle sticking out of a Puerto Rican's arm. So yeah. I was like, "What the hell is this?" It's like I would look at my uncles, they're like, "Yeah, I ain't like that."
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It was like, but as things, but that's what I'm saying. Like now, it's strange that you start to see that the playing field has changed so much, and it's a great thing. That's why I never knock evolution. I always like. Things have to evolve, and to see, you know, graffiti go from what you know, in the 80s, from what I was doing, which was basically, like I said, we did it for each other's attention. We didn't care less who else was paying attention to what was going on.
Yeah, you did it for the art, you know what I mean? Craft.
We did it because we never would have thought that we would make a living off of what we're doing. I mean, I can still hear my mother's voice going, that graffiti stuff in Spanish. She would tell me, that graffiti stuff is going to leave you nothing in life. Now she'll call. She's like, can you send me $100? And it's like, oh, okay. But it's just, it's strange to see. But I don't knock it, you know, but it's strange to see how the acceptance, but it had to happen. It will continue happening because eventually, you know, those Monets and the Goyas and the Picassos that you see in these museums are going to be replaced with guys like us, because the people that, you know, are only getting older and want to see it and understand it and it's part of their lifestyles, you know, this is their version of what brought color to their life.
Yeah, I agree. Do you have what type of stuff are you guys working on now?
Oh, we've for years we've always done like a lot of corporate stuff. We're in the middle of doing across from the new World Trade Center, across from the Freedom Tower.
Yeah,
there's a W Hotel there. We're doing some backdrop at a bar that faces it. It's like an outdoor bar. We're doing some hair care product. Company event, and we do a lot of live painting stuff, and then we also do a lot of licensing. So it's kind of like there's so many things on the table here right now that's you know, we're in the middle of. But you know, the idea is just to keep working and get your work out there.
Yeah. And as far as rap artists, have you continued down that path working with the rappers?
Yeah. I mean, you know. I mean, keep in mind, like, Joe, before he started rapping, Fat Joe, I'm talking about, he was actually part of our crew, and he was just a street bomber. He loved to bomb and paint. So, but we just did a project with him. But, I mean, our doors now went from just hip-hop stuff early on to we've done stuff for groups like Metallica.
Yeah.
Jennifer Lopez, Mariah Carey. I think we've done a total of like 26, 27 music videos for people. It's crazy. Like, the best part of my job is never the same thing twice. That, you know, being able to do always something new. So, you know, who knows who calls and who emails next.
Do you have any favorite pieces around the world that you've done?
You know what?
I know it's a tough question.
The next one I do, I guess, is going to be my favorite.
There you go.
Good answer.
Yeah, it's like, for me, it's like there's been so many. Can you imagine 30 yeah. years worth of work without stopping? But we've done stuff for hospitals. And I guess one of my most memorable and I guess favorite, just because of the emotional attachment, we painted inside of a children's, I think it was in St. Barnabas Hospital, we painted inside a children's play area in a children's wing that the kids have had AIDS.
Yeah.
And we went and we turned the room into like an indoor fish tank. So they felt like they were playing in a fish tank.
Nice.
So it was kind of like, it was cool because afterwards we went in and the kids came in and they played with us. And you know, the floor. They had all these like spongy things on the floor. It was kind of cool. But,
yeah.
What about the?
But you know, you have moments like that.
Can you talk about the response you got from the Big Pun mural that you guys did? I mean, that had to be. I mean, a lot of people were, especially in the Bronx, were not just fans, had real love for Pun when he died. So to be able to do that mural, and you guys were solely responsible for that mural.
I kind of heard the question. I know you're referring to the Pun mural.
Yeah. Yeah, talk about the response. Like, emotionally, when people, I mean, there was a lot of emotion tied to his fan, him with his fans. It was short life, you know, wasn't around very long, but was loved by so many.
But for us in the 90s, there was a certain time. Yeah, I guess you can find, there's a book called NYC, R.I.P. NYC, right? But there was a time in the 90s where we were asked to do a lot of memorial walls. And I guess being that we did so many, we were kind of like known as like the memorial wall kings, because we had something like over 40, over 50 memorial walls at, you know, one time in New York City. But Pun, we had met early on through Joe, before Joe had signed them. They were just kind of like palling around, and Pun was a guy from the neighborhood that we knew. So, you know, again, he's another person you met before the fame and before. And if you ever met Pun, Pun was a dude that loved to snap. Like, wherever you was at, like, I remember I used to wear these Versace glasses, and he always called them Cazelles, and I would have to get on his size 50-foot toe Timberland. Like, you know, it was like, with Pun was one of those dudes that even though he was big, he was used to being snapped on all the time, he was quick to throw them at you first before you got one off on him.
Yeah.
So you're like, yo, this dude don't leave you alone. So, you know, like, so, but we knew him, you know, before the fame and everything, and it so happens we were in the middle of doing a campaign for him. When we got the call, actually, we got a call at our office. We were getting ready to go out to do one of the campaign walls. And a friend of ours called, said, yo, I just heard on the radio, Pun had passed. Is that true? I'm like, nah. So then Bye got a call on his phone. BG got a call. Then everybody started calling, like, either the office or cell phones. And we were like, nah. So Bye was like, you know what, let me find out. So he calls Joe, and Joe's wife picked up. And he said, yo, is it true? And she was like, yeah, you know, Joe's inside with him right now. He just passed. So we're like, oh, shit. So we're sitting here in the office, and our van was packed and ladders. And, you know, we were ready to go paint, you know, to do our job, which was doing the promotional campaign. And at that point, it was kind of like, there was this one wall that we had done where it was like this character that I drew. The guy had like a Puerto Rican bandana on, and he had like a bulletproof vest on, and he had these two Glocks on, and he was shooting, like, you know, it was a cool image, and it was always on the wall. So when Pun shot his 8x10 photo, you know, that black and white photo they give out, you know, I guess it was a profile photo or something like that, whatever they call it.
Yeah.
So he liked the wall so much that he was like, you know, he took the photo in front of that wall. So when we were going out to go paint, we were like, well, you know what, let's do him a memorial wall and let's cover that, and that'll become his wall, you know, forever. Like, you know, that image that he loved so much because he was going to get it tattooed on him and all that, let's give it to him. So we went and we started with no plan. We just started doing a memorial wall. We got the CD cover. Actually, back then it was a cassette. I had the cassette cover in my hand, and we just started, you know, laying it out, and it kind of came together. And we didn't tell anybody. We just went out and did it. And it you know, all of a sudden, I think Angie Martinez got wind of it, and she said we were painting at that block. It's on 163rd and Reverend St. James Polite Street here in the Bronx. And we turned around, and it was like 20 people. And, you know, we kept painting, turned around again. It was like 80 people. You kept painting, and next thing you know, it was like a sea of people. And it's like everyone pulled up with cars and their trunks open and playing Pun's music. And, you know, Jimmy from Jimmy's Bronx Cafe sent over trays of food. And, you know, like, it was just, you know, it kind of like showed the love that everyone had for Pun, and they showed out. I mean, no one was invited. It's kind of like, you know, and it kind of like shows slightly our world of what these memorial walls meant to the families that were getting them done. They become kind of like the tombstone on the block. It's kind of like you can look over your shoulder and it's like the person never left. You can still see his image on your block. And it's, for some people, like these walls become wailing walls. You come over, it's like they're still there. You could talk to them. It's funny, one of the years, I think it was the second year that we did it, because then we started to do it, change the image every year after that. And I think we did, in between like the 11-year period, we must have did about 8 of them, because we couldn't, sometimes we were just away and we couldn't get to it. But I remember, I think it was the second year, Flavor Flav came over. And, you know, and I couldn't get him off the wall. He kept talking upon the image we had there. And he started crying, and I'm trying to move him to the side so he could finish painting the shirt. And he was like, "You don't understand." I'm like, "Yo, chill, just move to the side. Let me just paint down here, and then you can go back to it." But it's just because, you know, these walls, they become a point of whether it's grieving, good memories, or, you know, they have a power in these communities. And, you know, these communities, it's a shame that we don't do them as much as we did, but for a lot of communities where we painted these memorial walls, they kind of became, you know, a healing process.
Yeah.
You know, or a way, you know, we caught a lot of flack at one point for doing a lot of those walls. We would go to community board meetings and they would like try to ostracize us and be like, "You guys are promoting, you know, the street violence." And our answer to them was always like, "Would you rather we sweep it under the rug? This is what's going on in our community. These kids are getting shot. These kids are, you know, giving up their lives for fast money. And some of them are, you know, victims of, you know, being at the wrong place at the wrong time." And for a lot of people that we did memorial walls, they were people who died of old age, people who had illnesses, people. So it wasn't always like street related stuff, but, you know, but being that we did so many of them, like, everyone assumed automatically that, you know, it was street violence stuff, and it wasn't.
Who were some of the walls that you painted memorials to? Just name a few.
Man. We did so many. See, that was the best part of like these memorial walls.
Yeah.
They weren't movie stars. They weren't.
So they were tributes to people in the community.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is that these average, everyday people who passed in these communities were loved enough by their family members and friends that they would find us. They would come from Brooklyn, come from Queens, they would come from all over, and they would ask us to go to their neighborhoods, and, you know, they would have a wall set up, and, you know, they'd be like, you know, they'll commission us to get out there and paint. They wanted a wall because they want to celebrate these people's lives. So it was like, it wasn't your movie stars, it wasn't your sports players, these are average, everyday, you know, people in the hood.
Yeah, the people that make up the community. I dig that. Do you, in closing, what message would you give to up-and-coming writers? There's a kid right now in the Bronx, or there's a kid in Japan, or there's someone in Flint, Michigan, or Ohio, or California, or anywhere in the world right now. And like, you can obviously reach them through this podcast or on YouTube. Yeah. Like, what would you say to them to inspire them to keep doing what they're doing?
I would say just that. Just keep doing what you're doing. I mean, you're going to find opposition because it's constant. When you're doing something creative, not everyone sees the vision.
Yeah.
And if you believe in it strongly enough, and you see it in your head, and you believe in what you're doing, there should be no reason for you to stop. Just own your craft, learn as much as you can. Again, I've been doing this over 30 years, and I'm still, hopefully one of these days I'll get it right, but I've been doing this over 30 years, and I'm still learning, and it's something that, you know, I'll be old and gray, and if I'm in a wheelchair, then they'll just be smaller pieces. But it's just, I'm going to keep doing it until my last breath, and how you have to go at it. I mean, believe in it. If you're a rapper, rap till your last breath. If you're a DJ, get yourself a Serato if you're laying on your deathbed and just rock out. I mean, do what you got to do. Just if you believe in it strongly enough, you know, you're going to continue doing it for you, not for someone else. So.
That's what's up. One more time, tell listeners where they can find you on social media and how they can contact you.
Yeah, you can reach us at TatsCrew.com, TatsCrew.net. Through there, you're going to find media links on Twitter and Facebook and, you know, the Instagram. All of a sudden, everyone's Instagramming. I think my partner's fingers are falling off from someone's Instagram. But, I mean, you know, you can reach us through the site, and we should have all the links there. And, you know, it's been a pleasure talking to you. So
yeah, it was great. I really appreciate you being on the program. We're just a little show trying to make our way and find our way in this this sea of technology, but we come from the same era as you, same mindset, same vision, and we're just going to keep pressing forward. So nice, sir. I appreciate you spending time with us.
Thanks, guys, and everybody else on the panel. You know, it was nice meeting you guys, and again, our door is always open, so, you know, if we can help you guys with anything, just feel free.
Thanks,
all right,
man.
Appreciate it. I'll give you a call back in a little bit and recap.
All right, no doubt, guys.
All right.
Peace.
Yeah, bye.
Peace.
That's what's up, huh?
That was the shit.
Huh? He was dropping knowledge.
There's nothing to say.
So wise.
Yeah, we were just...
That guy just...
He was saying everything.
I mean,
but
guy,
beautifully. He was saying it maybe better than me.
That guy loves... you can tell he loves what he does.
Yeah,
it
passionate.
It did not stop. I mean, I was caught up just listening.
Like a seminar.
I saw you. I was watching you.
I was listening. Well, I mean, I felt like a 12-year-old kid, like, getting to look behind the curtain. I'm looking at the Wizard of Oz, like, whoa.
Wow.
Look at this dude. Yeah. That's a big deal, man.
That's awesome.
Yeah, well, thanks for producing it, man.
Oh,
You know, I just got the equipment. You know,
that dude.
That was great.
Yeah, that was cool. And one of the things that I loved about this, and just talking to other people, is that they love their craft. They're not in it for the money. They're not looking at it. They're looking at it, what they're doing right now in this project, and then they'll go to the next one.
Yeah.
They're doers, you know, and we've talked about this more than enough. I've vented about it more than enough on the podcast, is about focusing on what you're doing and then investing in yourself and surrounding yourself with like minds, even better minds than yours. Because if you do something and, you know, you're doing it because of the fame and the glory and the gold, then, you're in it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
And you're going to have a short career. Like a lot of the cats today running around in rap music, if you're doing it for all the Lambos and the alcohol and the women and stuff like that, all the stuff that they're portraying right now, you know, it's not for the right reason. Like you said, you could not foresee this back in the day. Like when I was spinning, I did a little graffiti, but I did more on DJing, and that was what I focused on: DJing and writing. And writing, when I mean rhymes and stuff like that, we didn't do it for the payday. We just did it. It entertained us.
Yeah.
You know, it was entertaining. We would do it to hone our skills,
mm-hmm.
and we would test those skills on battles and block parties and doing events and stuff like that. And that's it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when someone would come to me and be like, "Oh, rap music's going to be dead in, you know, a few years or whatever," I mean, that would personally hurt me. Like,
yeah.
I remember coming to tears as a young teenager, a young Malcolm Riddle, weighing
that?
About 128 pounds with the same size head. It was, you know, it was a magical time. Hip hop for me, the evolution of it, and he hit on that. He loves to watch. Nicer said, he loves to watch the evolution. Everything must evolve.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I have to be better at as a listener and within my life within hip-hop and rap culture, is to be able to open my ears and mind and say, this is a stage where it is evolving. And, yeah, there's some corporate hands involved in it, a lot, actually.
Yeah. He did say, though, that outside of overseas is where
the love
it's appreciated even more.
Yeah.
That's what he did. He did say that.
Yeah.
He did say that some of the stuff he listened to here, he doesn't like it either.
No. Yeah. No, a lot of cats are like that.
You're talking about flow.
Yeah, that makes sense. Listen, how bad does rap have to be here to not understand what someone's saying and like that more.
Yeah, yeah. That's a big statement. That's
well, then
true.
I don't think they're working on the craft. They're not
today here.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's
more.
It's
not about
substance.
You're right.
No. The writing's different. I mean, we hit on that subject with the Michael Jackson album, and this is outside of rap, but just in general, listening to
the Escape album.
Excuse me. The writing in it, listening to the stories, is different than just the graphic writing that's done today.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe my ears are getting old, but I don't think so. I think creativity. I think that the artists out there that are putting in the work, you'll see in the long run. You know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, what's remembered and who's evolved and who's still standing. Mm-hmm. Tats Crew, they're still here.
A long time.
And graffiti itself, it's evolved, but the platform of evolution is within the technology. The art itself is the same. Yep. You know what I mean? It's the same. Yep. Yeah, they can take a piece of art and put it into the computer and be able to transfer it or send it somewhere around the world in a blink of an eye. But the art itself, that foundation, the soul, it's the same as it was in 83. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's the same. And of course, when you get the corporate the corporate moguls out there, when they get their hands into it, you get a Beat Street, or you get, I like Beat Street, except for the closing credits, a song, but no disrespect to Melly Mel, but you know, my ears were like I said, a little listening to something different, but at the same time, we needed that. You can't exist, you can't come to where you are now without having the Beat Streets. You know what I mean? We needed that. And that just pushed us forward.
That's part of the culture.
I liked what he said, too, about Beat Street, when he said, you know, I'm painting on trains. This guy's painting himself furniture. And he was saying, I have a couch, or I have a dresser. I don't have to paint one. So the idea of, even back then, when hip-hop was in its infancy and graffiti as well, there was that mystery behind it. No one knew what graffiti artists did other than paint on trains. So someone somewhere, a producer, a director, decided that, hey, if a graffiti artist, you know, where do they live? Well, they put him in an abandoned building.
Yeah,
that's how they imagined it.
Where he had to paint his own furniture.
They fill in the blanks. Yeah. And they do that today. They do that. Yeah. That runs rampant in the black community. That runs rampant in the Arab community. Yep. That runs rampant in the Spanish community.
And he picked up on it. Beat Street's an old movie. It's been a while now since it came out. And he knew even back then when he was watching this, you know, taking offense to, hey.
It was wrong.
You know, even though what he was doing was considered, it was illegal. Yeah. And this is a guy who, again, people thought that, and when he said it too, that about the music, that he'd show up to a train yard and there'd be guys who listened to heavy metal there too, you know, bombing trains.
Yeah.
So it was a stereotype that even people in the community didn't understand. No one knew. And that's, I was mystified by it. Like I said, I had no idea who they were, what they looked like.
Well, right. That was the whole mystery behind it. It's just like you don't know that you're with the rival. You know, tagger.
Yeah, riding a train. Yeah. I thought, I mean, that was, that whole interview.
It's very fascinating.
Yeah.
It's an in-depth look in a world that many know little about. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, even myself included, I still know the basics. But like I said, this went hand in hand with what the lifestyle I grew up in, growing up all over the U.S., but mainly in the hip-hop era out of Detroit, Flint, Michigan. There were DJs. There were beatboxers. There were MCs. There were graffiti writers. I mean, it was just there. I didn't question it. Yeah, I didn't question it. If I saw it, I would look at it and I would try it. Like, I can beatbox. I can DJ. I can write rhymes. I can do some graffiti. It was just something you did.
Yeah, I think, and when you had your crew back in the day,
Kid Fresh,
everybody could do all of those things. Everybody could, but you always had the one guy who was really good at
DJ
one thing.
Defcon.
Yeah, one guy was really good at another, right? So we'd go out Friday night and you know just loiter, And there'd always be the one guy who had the spray can, yeah. and everywhere we went, he'd make sure people knew we were there.
Yep.
You know, and he had the guy who was beatboxing, and he had the other guy who was rhyming.
Everyone had a skill,
yeah.
and everyone had a purpose.
Yeah.
And yeah, mine evolved into the music guy. I was the DJ. I had the boombox. It was basically the size of this table right here. Yeah, it was very large. I used to carry, just like now. You hear me complaining
when
said, "Yeah, I got equipment. I need batteries.
Now it's your mixer, computer, iPad.
I needed all this stuff, and it's the same thing. Nothing's changed, people. You listening to this? We're giving you pearls here, but it was fun at that period, at that time. And it went, you know, first time I heard. Nicer was saying Bam, but I didn't want to make sure that the listeners knew he was talking about Africa.
I think he said Africa Bambaataa at some point.
Yeah, but you know, sometimes, you know, depending on who's listening, they may or may not know. But Bam was the first time I heard.
That's how you call him.
Yeah, Bam was Planet Rock when that first came on. The first time I heard it, you know, I heard it. My parents had a Ford. I think it was a Ford wagon here. It had like the wood on the sides, you know what I mean? The 8-track player. My mom would be playing Peaches and Herb. And I remember I took it out, took the 8-track out, and Planet Rock came on, and it changed everything for me. When I heard that, you know, it was game on. So that time period, I knew I was in a special time. Like you, Miriam has heard me say, you know, the fucking 80s, man. I mean, you know, it was just a time where the 70s and 80s, where there are things right now. There are multi-million dollar a year industry, if not billion dollar a year industries, that was born in that time period. And if you had your eyes open, your ears open, you could hear it and see it, but you didn't know that it. Like you said, you didn't know that it, DJs get what, 50 grand, 100 grand for an appearance. Yeah. They're not even DJing. Yeah. I mean, they are, but it's not really a disc, you know. But at the same time, it's the evolution of that craft.
Yeah.
Who knew that was going to happen? You know, that's why it's important that if you're an artist, if you're a writer, if you want to make films, if you, you know, want to run a business, if you want to do what Rick Marrero's doing, running a business every day, day in and day out, you have to show up. You have to show up, whether you like it or not. You got to show up. You got to go through the hills and valleys.
Yeah.
Okay? Everyone, you know, people talk about passion, and you got to be passionate. You got to have fun. Yeah, there's going to be fun, but at the same time, there's going to be times when you're not having fun. I'm sure, Rick, you can agree. You know what I mean? We know.
I can agree.
I went through this whole winter, you know, just struggling. Now I'm starting to see things pick up in far as, you know, my craft in the wine business. And even with the podcast, I mean, there were hills and valleys, but you have to stick to it. You know, you don't give up. If you're out there in California right now and your dream is to become an actor, or your dream is to do anything, and you're just out in the West Coast, don't give up. You know, you may be having a hard time for the next 6 months, but that's part of the deal. That's your commitment. So you got to be committed.
Yeah.
So
it's true.
Hats off to the Tatch crew, because that's raw commitment, uncut raw commitment. Their lives were at stake. I mean, the cops would chase you, shoot you. You know what I mean? That was a period of time where they would beat you, and there was no YouTube. There were no cell phone pictures or videos. No one could fight, stand up for your rights.
Yeah.
There were very few Al Sharptons of the world. They were there, but I mean, there were a lot of Puerto Rican brothers and sisters out there that took the billy club to the head. You know, African American, white Americans. You know, because that's one of the things that I've always loved about the hip hop culture in a whole. Was we all came from all sorts of backgrounds.
Yep.
You know what I mean? In my crew, there was Puerto Ricans, Mexicans. There were, African Americans, Native Americans, Asian Americans. I mean, all over. It was a crew.
Yep.
And we didn't question that. When you find your crew, you stick with your crew. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I've stuck to my crew. I still talk to my people.
Stick with your crew, people.
You gotta do what
you gotta
do. So
what's up? You guys like that one?
Yeah,
that was really great.
You know what's? They were there. They were there in the beginning.
Yeah,
like in the beginning of hip hop.
Yeah,
they didn't even realize that it was that connected, though. You know,
they did.
That's what's amazing,
just for the art. So, yeah, you listeners listening, yeah, this was a treat. And I think Rick has another episode he may produce coming soon.
Oh, yeah?
It'll tie. I mean, you talk about crew. Are we talking about Prince Punch and Pat?
Tell us.
Wait, what?
Prince Punch and Pat, is that what you're talking about?
I don't know. Oh, that's a different one.
Oh, what's the other
one? Yeah, you were talking about, okay, so we have, just to give you guys listening, Rick and I usually talk offline, usually when we're here at the restaurant in Gainesville, Virginia, Desiderio, and he's got all these ideas, this guy, man. He's all over the place. He's trying to cook food, roll meatballs, you know what I mean? And then coming to me about producing podcast episodes. So one of them was
Prince, creative.
What's his name?
Prince Punch and Pat.
Yeah, Google him, YouTube. This is an interesting character.
Just Google him. I grew up with him. From my neighborhood.
Yeah.
Okay.
Another story of a guy who came from, you know, just a guy in the neighborhood.
He's a prince.
Now, and he traced back his lineage. He's a prince, a Nigerian prince.
Yeah.
He's a boxer.
Yeah.
Holds some records. He's a kickboxer, you know, jiu-jitsu. He's in Australia, he's in Germany, he's in Canada. I mean, he's all over the world. Check him out, Prince Punchin'
So
Pat.
We got that, and I think you also talked about Diddy's...
And I reached out to those guys and waiting for it. There was a couple guys. There's one guy who's real big in paintball in Canada.
Yeah.
Huge.
He's a producer. Rick Marrero is the hip-hop...
I went to high school with Usher's barber. I got a haircut so bad, me and my friend, off the subject, a friend of mine, we decided to cut each other's hair. I think I might have mentioned this a while back. He wanted the little Mike Tyson, the little half moon, and I did that. I thought that was easy.
Yeah.
And then he just fucked up my hair. So we went to Curtis's house, his name was Curtis, and he just looked at my hair, shook his head, and said, there's nothing I can do.
Can't hook. You're just
going
to
let it grow. That's how bad. Because I didn't want to go to the barber and show him what this guy just did to my friend just did.
And we went, shame.
So he said, come here, let me help you out. I'll take you to Curtis's house.
Yeah.
And he just looked. I remember, shook his head, started laughing. Said, nothing I can do for you. And him, too. You know, he had a little barbershop in the Bronx. And now, I mean, he's all over the world, has hair care products. That he.
I was talking to one of your employees here, Miranda. She's a artist as well. And I was like, we're doing an interview with the Tatch Crew, graffiti artists. Rick. Rick knows a lot of people. She couldn't believe it. She couldn't believe you had cred.
And now, if you would have told her I was a
believe it.
You know, grade A asshole, she would have believed that. Yeah, yeah. She would have believed that.
She has a different perspective of you, huh?
Yeah.
She said, yeah. That, what did she say? Rick ain't gangster. That's what she said. Quote. I was like, I was like, he's Bronx. You know what I mean? It's in the blood.
You don't know who you know until you get older and look back and I'm like, man, these guys, they do a lot. Yeah. They do a lot.
Well, in closing, we appreciate you. And Miriam Tazi.
What's up?
Thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having
me. Glad you
me.
Could make it. I was worried that you couldn't make it to this show. Yes. But Rick's doing some business behind closed doors right now because duty calls. But you guys listening, thanks for listening. Support the Tatch Crew. Support all your local artists out there, no matter
and
where businesses. They come from or what they're doing. Definitely. And support American Riddle. So thank you. And own your craft. Know your craft. And stick with your craft. Domino motherfucker. Control this rap like Napoleon, half Mongolian, holy, you owe me in, rock him like Manolium, yeah, Lex, diamond, shining like he rhyming, 929, titanium glass, time to play that ass, whirlwinds of friends, come moving intense, time to pull again, release the shell well, make him yell again, so sleep, but I'ma be maxing in sweets, counting your paper, and counting your sheeps, hitting your chicken jeeps, miraculously, attacking faculty, who wanna tackle me, your Jack Mack kidnapper for free, what? You got heat, you better pop those. We moving like Gestapo's through underground potholes to rock those. Much land discoveries, chrome rims, sipping bubbly. Who living lovely? Half a brick to cover me, so dissing me. Come on now, listen, G. Use a dime, I'm a key. Dun dun, straight out of Sicily. Now back to the stash crib. Joey crack bagging up cracks. One love, giving G packs. We getting knots like stockbrokers who won't marry us. Blast shots for all my niggas who splash cops. The rich, holy, oh,
camp is here. 1001 corner thumb, fake a jack.
I be the infamous who leaves no witnesses.
Cracks the wickedest.
Run up in your crib, blast your kids. Ain't no myth in this, shit's official. I pistol whip you with my Smith and Wesson. Cause my obsession with sending rappers to heaven gets me in the rushing. You need protection from the smooth assassin. Who really moves in action? Blasting motherfuckers, execution fashion. Now who's the fat one that you love to hate? Catch you at your mother's wake. Smack you, then I whack you with my stuff tray. It doesn't take much to make me restless. Look at my face and definitely lose your breath. When you chuck up my space, it's lessons. You want test this? So really, I make one call. I have the whole room coming on the ferry. I'm very dangerous and well connected. I'm puffing out with method and try to decide who's next to feelings nicely. So respected and admired, the boss retired, you lost. Wu-Tang, your terror squad, buy a condor.
Like stockbrokers who own Marriott's. Blast shots for all my niggas who splash cops. Rich Coley on campus here. 1001 a corner thug, fake a jack, you be your corner.
You guys despise guys like us, disgust like Spartacus. You cuss, it claim the bus. You lust for a part of us, you thrust but can't touch. Plus, we fall from any type of fellas you can trust. Put the pressure on the mic, a bench press to your chest. Sound like sweat on my back, we're having sex, tight ass flex. Pretty Pocahontas, pussy sweet like my new tech. Sis got curves like a GS300X. My body's 95% alcohol, 5% cancer. Sosa Diamonds, Getty Lucci, blaze it up like Bonanza. Catch me in the cut, easy Jesus burning my gut. As I remember my menage a trois with Mardi Gras sluts. I question mark your heart, punctuate your fate. All your verbs and predicates done as well as you pronunciate. In the rep, we're going to break you off the aisle. Take CO's hostage, A-Rap style, no surrender.
Get nuts like stockbrokers who own Marriott's. Blast shots for all my niggas who splash cops. Rich Coley on campus here. 1001 a corner thug, fake a jack, you be your corner.
Yeah, I'm all about business and enterprising. Advising financial advisors on franchising to widen their horizons. Devising ideas with masterminders. Moving on the stash with diamonds. First we get the cash, then we laugh like miners. Don't get me wrong, I'm a funny bastard. But when it come to money done, I'm not the one to laugh with. I'm after for what cash could bring me, brothers. Me and my demon lovers blasting, laughing hyenas back to ringling. Brothers, believe the mothers, you the best jester still. I'm investing meals on a hunch over lunch, muffin on the Chesterfield. Well, why test the real scandalous? I'm at the Sands in Los Angeles, planning hits with an animus philanthropist. Spanish kids, close to God like evangelists, chopping niggas up and making sandwiches.
Like stockbrokers who own Marriott's. Blast shots for all my niggas who splash cops. Rich Coley on campus here. 1001 a corner thug, fake a jack, you be a corner.